Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck, and I am the host of this show. My guest tonight is Sam Bradley, author of the upcoming book entitled Bridge Building. Sam's message is not only for a Christian audience, or it might be that you might think so, but I think all of us who are spiritually inclined can learn from Sam's message as well. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Sam Bradley. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Kate.
How are you this evening?
I'm great. Glad to be here. Looking forward
Wonderful.
To spending this time.
Thank you. And you are calling from Atlanta, Georgia?
The metro Atlanta area, yes. Sunny South.
So your book is called Bridge Building, and I would like to know, or tell us what that means, and how do you describe that in your book?
Well, the concept of building a bridge over hardships and some of the debilitating things that we face in life is one that came to me on a flight, an overnight flight over India while returning from Asia, and I just awoke with this concept of this bridge, and the book that evolved out of this into a three-part book of containing a powerful message of hope by giving primarily it's written towards men, but to give men and women a biblical guidance for the path of transformation.
Well, I think that the fact that you have primarily written this for men is really needed, because so many women are writing for women, not really primarily, I think we all can gain so much from each other's messages, but tell us a little bit why this is, why men need to hear this.
Well, I teach mainly from personal experience, and, I'm not a theologian, I'm not a scholar, not a clinician or professionally trained counselor, but what I found in my own search, I use the resources that medical science offers and professional counseling, and then I use the spiritual principles that I found in the Bible in a time of my life where I just became utterly broken and reached like the utter pit of despair, no energy. It's hard to think and look forward. And so what I want to offer men are principles that I discovered that helped me to gain a stability within, where we can start to get strength for making that transformational change without.
Yes, it seems like you're giving them a message of hope so that the people who are experiencing extreme mental anguish are not tempted, or at least don't go through with the temptation of, say, committing suicide or doing terrible harm to themselves or somebody else.
That's true. I've been there with suicidal depression and, can speak to it because of it. And, again, that's part of the foundational drive behind wanting to show how giving control of our lives to God can enable us in His power to bring about those healing changes, and how this principle is available to anyone that choose to act on it.
Right, and you come from a background of law enforcement, and do you think that's where a lot of your post-traumatic stress came from?
It did, that and a violent childhood, in which I only learned that in counseling a couple of years ago, that when I had to take some online assessments and prior to attending this counseling for 4 weeks, was that a lot of it came out of what I thought was a normal, you know, I mean, it's like, isn't every child beaten for doing wrong? And was given the understanding that what I took as normal was traumatic for a child. And then add 21 years in law enforcement of just seeing the brutality that people can commit against each other, you know, being shot at, those kind of things. We just tend to store them up. You know, they're unpleasant to talk about, think about. And, you know, that's one of the hardest things about counseling, is to go back in and open those wounds. So, yes, the law enforcement contributed greatly to the post-traumatic stress disorder. And as a result of that, just a chronic depression and acute anxiety, that I still struggle with.
Yet your struggle has probably lessened with the work that you're doing, I would think.
It has. I realized only after I started writing the book, when I was looking into the foundation, go back to this flight again, when I feel like God just prodded me awake, and of course, you know, I started whining. You know what? I'm sick. I don't feel like writing anything down. He's like, get up and write this down. So dug an envelope out of my backpack, and I sketched all this out. And the foundation for this this bridge analogy is grounded in Luke 4:18, where Jesus, when he began his ministry, he goes to a synagogue in Nazareth, and he teaches and claims to give us five foundational promises. And when he gets done reading, he sits down. He hands the scroll of Isaiah back to the attendant, and he sits down, and he looks at all eyes were upon him, and he said, "Today I tell you that these five things are accomplished in your hearing." And so I thought, well, if we have this these five things, and I'll just run down through them. He offers forgiveness for sin, resulting in new spiritual life. He offers healing for brokenheartedness, healing for deliverance from the penalties of being in a sin fallen world. Offers spiritual sight or insights into his teachings. And then the offer of freedom from the power of sin. And this is where our addictions lie, that power where the evil, if you will, that holds over us. So in looking at those five, you know, foundational promises, I began to study that, but I failed to see where it's going to lead. I'm like, well, that's a great message, but, you know, where do I go from there? So when I got home, I began to study, and I come up on, you know, to experience something. What if it requires faith? I can't have it until I exercise faith. And I like the way Charles Spurgeon, an old English preacher from the 1800s, explains an aspect of faith. It's like when somebody writes us a check. We decide whether, based on our knowledge of the one that wrote that check, that person's worthy of our faith. And if so, we'll take it. We'll take that faith, and belief will lead us to the bank, and we'll recash it in. So that promissory note's only good if we can cash in on the power of that promise.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And I just want to clear up the definition of sin. I know that sin is widely used in a way of kind of creating a shame and a guilt kind of thing within people. But
yes.
I have also, but within spiritual texts, sin is seen as missing the mark. It's like an archer's term. And the mark that is missed is love. So if we can experience life through a perception of love, and of course that is maybe easier said than done, but not really, you know, you have to practice these things. But that sin is missing the mark, and the mark is sin, or the mark is love, that we need, that I believe that is a definition of sin that I feel comfortable with. How about you? What do you think about that?
Actually, that's one of the very definitions when Christians struggle with, well, what is sin? Is it the failure to keep rules and regulations or religious rituals? But it is mm-hmm. described, one aspect of it, as missing the mark. And it's very true that God's desire, these five promises I just talked about, are rooted mm-hmm. and grounded in love. If you believe the biblical message that Jesus made the claim to be the Son of God, he came down here on a mission, with a mission of love to redeem what's been lost. And that's the love relationship between humankind and the Creator God. So you're absolutely right. Sin causes us to miss that mark of love. And Ed,
yeah.
There is a lot of guilt that can come with that. You know, if we feel like we failed to measure up. But, you know, God has rules and regulations that he put down, like any organized society has to have to maintain order.
Yeah.
God has never been a rule-oriented. Now, he's had laws to protect us. There's dietary laws in the Old Testament. You know, there's laws against murder and hatred. But God's desire is to have that relationship of love. And
which is mystical, isn't it? Wouldn't you say?
Oh,
it's a mystical mystical perception that goes beyond rules and regulations. You know that that you were just describing.
Exactly, and you know, as men, we get all the facts and the nuts and bolts about love. Oh yeah, I can read the definition of it in 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7, and we understand that intellectually. But
mm-hmm.
How do you explain that emotional response of love, that feeling of love when you fall in love? That's mystical. There's no other way around it, and it's wonderful.
Well, we're talking about that. Here we are speaking about that kind of love that people have for one another, and it is Valentine's Day. So it's important to make that distinction between the love of the divine, that the divine has for us, and hopefully we can grow that love towards the divine through transformational, mystical perception. But with people, it's important to realize that the love that we have for each other is just maybe a microcosm of the macrocosm. That love is just as important as the love we have for the divine or God. And it's a beautiful lesson that can be learned through the day such as this, Valentine's Day, where love is really put first and foremost in everybody's mind.
Mm.
And, you know, Jesus'
gospel
was the gospel of love.
Yes. And I like your analogy. It's a greater picture of love contained within what we feel like are the smaller part of our lives. And, you know, it's like, how can I really affect and do for people? But we can't. And, you know, what you're saying, it makes me think of my son Jake and I did for my wife Chris for Valentine. She's also a police officer. She has she's at work tonight, and she had to work last night. So Jake and I went out, and I could have sent her a text message going, hey, I love you, happy Valentine's. But to go out and reach out more in that, and delve into that mystical aspect of love, go out and buy the roses and the cards and set them up with a spotlight shining on them with Godiva chocolate. That's an act of love going beyond that that factual, of course I love you, that, you know, men typically fall into. And when it comes to hearing the love message of God, there actually are ways to not only reach up to that divine and reach out for that divine aspect of love, but to reach out to others. And in the second part of the book, there's seven basic teachings of Christ where he says, all right, I've given you the five promises and the foundation. If you believe on them and act on them, I have seven basic commands. According to George Patterson at Western Seminary, he just boiled it all down. There's seven basic things, principles that we can implement. And if it's all right, I'll go through those, because number four, it talks about and we can park right there for a minute, loving God and loving others.
We just kind of boil it down to that, right?
Yes, absolutely. it's interesting, you know, we're going back to the concept of building a bridge. We've got five foundational promises, the foundations. You got to have that sure foundation if you want to raise the structure of a bridge that's going to uphold our transformation. So Jesus teaches us to repent or change our minds about the ways we view God and sin, and accept God's offer to, in effect, become a child, a spiritual child of his. And that's being saved from that penalty when we do wrong against ourselves and others. It's the acceptance of God's loving offer of forgiveness by having his son die on the cross and make that substitutionary death. And then his second instruction to us is to be baptized. It's a ritual that's visible, sometimes public display to identify ourselves with the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. And then he tells us, take communion with him. That ritual is just the symbolic brokenness of his body and the bread and his spilling his blood, his life's blood out for us on that cross when we drink of the juice. And it's a wonderful time to sit and reflect back on that act of love that brings us to this point to where we can love God and love others. And this is the requirement that's at the heart of Christianity. And it's the number one law of God, according to Jesus. He got grilled on it by the religious leaders of his day.
Yes, so as we learn to love as God loves, then we certainly can love people in much higher and kind of a transformational, elevated way than how most people view love is through jealousy and possessiveness and that sort of thing. And that's what that kind of love is. Doomed, really. I mean, it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, our lens, if you will, our perspectives about what love is and should be, is for me, was tainted by the childhood that I had. I had this image of God being a cruel taskmaster. I did not have a loving father figure in my, within my life. I had a brutal alcoholic as a father, and then my mother married. Divorced and remarried a man who turned out to be, the same way, just a cruel aspect of a man. And so, I developed my view of love based on, what was normal for me. And that was a very skewed, tainted lens of love.
Yes, but it's so, so wonderful that you have been able to rise above that. And it kind of reminds me of a guest I had recently by the name of Dan L. Hayes, and he's written about his trauma as his exact same sort of upbringing as yourself and the same cruel father image. And it sounds like you have two cruel father images, but the thing is his path was the the adult child of Alcoholics Anonymous, or as an adult child 12-step program. And that was his pathway. And he, he has blended a kind of a religious, spiritual model for his own recovery. And it was interesting because it's rough to have an upbringing like the two of you had. And he actually was approached by... He had written a book, and he was approached by publisher, the 12-step kind of publishing people, and they wanted him to be published through their publication company. And he just all of a sudden got this terrible feeling, I'm not good enough, and I can't do this, and he kind of ran away from it. And there you have a message that can really help people with our book, and we can't run away from helping other people with our message. That's my point. So, so I'm really, I know that you're going to go ahead with this, and I'm really happy that you are doing this. This is very important.
Yeah. Well, I can certainly relate to the fear that'll cause us to run away, especially a fear that's grounded in that core belief that we're not worthy. I mean, when you invited me to come on this show, I'm like, gosh, who am I to go in there and talk about this? It's one thing to write it, and it's been very hard to write personal experience in, because I was like, gosh, somebody will read this, and they'll see that, I'm really just a human after all, but they see me as that stigma that's associated with having emotional issues like depression and anxiety. And in fact, my first manuscript was pretty sterile, and a friend of mine in publishing reads it, and he says, I've looked through all of this, and how much of this have you actually experienced? I'm like, well, all of it. And his advice was, you have to write that in there. People want to know not only your claim that this is true, but how do you know it's true by experience?
And People love to read stories. And it's really important to put those stories in your work, which you have. And it makes it come alive.
Well, the manuscript I sent you is obviously a very rough draft. And when I go back and write it, and having to think about the manuscript in light of talking about it, has caused me to focus in on how to better bring that message out and how to better share. Like the issue of guilt, I don't think I hardly touched on it, but guilt is such a powerfully destructive aspect that many of us carry, you know, the guilt of things that we've done, you know, like in my failed first marriage, that guilt. And it comes from looking back and with perfect hindsight, right? You look back afterwards and go, oh, I should have known not to do that. And if you live in light of that perfect hindsight, it'll just literally crush us, it'll crush our spirits. So we have to go back to what we knew at that time. And sometimes, and I want to speak to people here that are just struggling with that guilt because of some issue that they've made the vows and the promises, they've gone to 12-step, they've attended counseling, but they've lapsed back. And after a while, you tend to just give up. I can never be better. I've disappointed God. How can God love me? I've disappointed my family. And we tend to withdraw and isolate. And guilt is a powerful thing to overcome that lurks back in the shadows. We see the pain. If I just hadn't had that childhood, and if I didn't have PTSD inflicted on me, I could just do better. There's guilt lurking back there. And so when I go back and do maybe the final revision, who knows, but one more revision, I've got to write to that and bring that message out and show how to personally deal with that issue of guilt.
Yeah.
And part of that is just being loving towards ourselves, you know. And
absolutely. That is the point I was just about to make. Absolutely true. That we can talk about love, but until we practice the art of taking care of ourselves and, yes, loving ourselves, not in any narcissistic way, but in a way that you can't really love anybody until you love yourself. And you have to enjoy your alone times and times of contemplation and solitude. And then speaking to guilt and shame, those things can only really be negated or balanced out through contemplation and solitude and times with yourself, you know, where there isn't, but maybe times in nature or times with your dogs or if you love animals, times with the animals.
Yeah.
And these things, you look for things that are healing to you that may not really be healing to anybody else. And that's, you know, you just practice those things until you just feel an exuberant sense of love for not only yourself, but for the whole of the world. What's that bumper sticker that says, bless the whole wide world, no exceptions? I love that. I just saw it today. I think that's so important. You know, we need to love ourselves and not in any ego way. Which does remind me of the fact that our books and our messages, it's about the message and it's not about the messenger. You know, it's about us being humble people who want to help others and our service to whomever we are helping and whoever is attracted to our message. But as soon as we think that it's all about the messenger, it's really over.
Yeah, that's true. You know, what you're saying speaks to my beliefs in the process of this. I wish there was a magic wand we could go and pray and, you know, just come away and it's all better. But it is a process, and part of the hardest person in this world, at least for me, to love is myself. And sometimes, you know, well-intended religious teaching is, if you you focus on yourself, you're going to get prideful. And that's true. That can happen. But the spiritual things, and this is what I love about the Bible, is the violence, the balance of teaching. You've got to have a balance. You don't want to go off into any extreme one way or the other. And if we go off into that extreme that we can't love ourselves and we just beat ourselves up, we'll never have a healthy self-esteem. I mean, how can we truly value others if we don't love and value ourselves and see us in? I mean, it helps for me to see myself in light of divine love, to better understand how my wife can really love me, because I struggle with that. You know, why would you? Because I see my fault, right? I mean, why would you? And she tells me, well, you know, your integrity and how important truth is. But, you know, that comes from being betrayed. And in some, I have that value from the hurtful things of life. And, you know, I can't explain, Kate, why a loving God allows some of the things to happen that he does. I just don't have an answer for it. I mean, some of the best minds down through the centuries of time have struggled with this answer, you know, of good versus evil. You know, if God is good, why does he allow this, this kind of thing? I mean, sometimes, I mean, suffering for me, if I hadn't gone through what I'd gone through, we wouldn't be having this conversation tonight if I'd lived this, you know, perfectly peaceful, wonderful life.
And, well, that's
I
the truth.
I long for that.
Don't you think that's the answer to your question?
Yes.
That is the answer to your question. It is not to say that we, you know, that we have a belief system that we have to suffer in order to grow. It's that certain suffering brings us closer to compassion. If you suffer, you suddenly realize that other people are suffering and we love them and have deeper feelings for what they're going through. Those things seem to work that way. And it's not like you're hoping not to suffer all the time, but when things happen, you lose a loved one or things bring you closer to some, it seems like the suffering brings you closer to divine love.
Yes. Yeah, you know, it's very odd, but for me, having a low self-esteem, I developed an air of superiority and arrogance out of it. It's like, well, if I can't be as good as them, I'll just bring them down here to where I am and do a lot of fault finding. And, you know, that was something that suffering and, I mean, in my face failure, I had to look at it and go, you know what, I caused this. I contributed to the failure of this marriage or, you know, the failure of a past career. And that is so humbling. But at the same time, if I don't go into that, just beat myself up with it, go, okay, what can I do to learn from it? I wouldn't have known empathy for others if I hadn't failed. And so that it goes back to those inspirational teachings about failure is the pathway to success. It really is, because we develop empathy and a true heart for others. I never really knew how to love until my heart was broken.
Mm-hmm.
And God showed me his deep love and what he did in sending his own son, you know, to stand in my place and just to bring this message of love, and that he still loves me. All those failures didn't change one bit. Of his love for me. And I love that story of the prodigal son that Jesus tells, the son that takes his father's inheritance and leaves and goes off and he blows all the money and he just ends up destitute. I mean, essentially in today's vernacular, he's eating out of dumpsters. And finally, he's like, you know, my dad's servants live better than this. I'll just go back and tell dad, you know, I don't deserve to be your son, but just let me work on the farm here. And the picture of that father is God waiting for us to reach up and come home, if you will. And Jesus says that father was watching that road for his son to come down it. And when he saw his son, he didn't stand there with arms crossed waiting for that apology, you know. He went running to him. Just fell on him. He hugged him. He kissed him. He had the servants bring out clean clothing and a new ring signifying his sonship. Just threw a big bash for his son to come home, and that's the way I see God. I mean, that's the way he's taught as being in the Bible. He's just that loving, benevolent, all powerful being waiting for us to come home.
Well, you know, there is so much in Christianity and certain types of thinking that sees God as a vengeful God, God with a sword, and all that kind of stuff. And I just, I'm so glad that that's not your vision, because I don't, our conversation tonight would really would be difficult. And,
and I grew up under that image.
Yeah.
And in the Old Testament, God, there's a record of God dealing, it had to be very stern with some of the ancient brutal ways of men. And mm-hmm. and again, that, you know, those questions come out. Well, gosh, how could God allow that? Even today, how can God allow innocent children to suffer and die in famine? You know, and I don't have an answer for it.
I
do know it's an aspect of this wonderful gift of having free will. We are free to choose and walk the path that that I mean, it's scary, because we got to determine what that healthy path is, or we'll miss that mark of love. But God gives us that freedom. And
mm-hmm.
I believe, being an intelligent being, he's given us a way to communicate with him in a written record contained within the Bible of how he interacts with us. But we have that wonderful freedom to choose that.
Yes, and as you had mentioned earlier, it's very important to take 100% responsibility for our lives, and not in any way that creates guilt or shame and hate towards yourself because you experience certain things, but it's a more of a compassionate 100% responsibility, where, you know, well, what could I learn from that? And yes, I did contribute to that. So many times you see people denying that they had anything to do with something. And that's,
mm-hmm.
you see it with crimes. I'm sure you've seen it, and many of the criminal mentality that you witnessed as a police officer. And I see it as a nurse. I am a nurse. And to me, police, law enforcement and nursing and firefighters, and we all have a certain viewpoint of human, what they're capable of
mm-hmm.
in terms of the dark side. And so many times the criminal mentality and people who are really suffering in despair do not see that they are responsible for the things that have happened to them or happened for them, or however you want to say it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the 100% responsibility is really 100% necessary.
You know, to be able to take that responsibility as a gift, you know, having low self-esteem, if someone criticized me, even lovingly, and tried to point something out, going, you know, you're pretty hateful with that person, I just didn't want to hear it, and I couldn't acknowledge it, so I'm like, I can't admit I'm wrong. And what I heard you talking about earlier is when you see that willful harm that people inflict, and then you say, well, you know, why did you do that? And they're like, what? But it's a gift to be able to go back and go, you know what, I did do that wrong, and that's real guilt, and it's helpful. When I do someone wrong, I need to feel that guilt and let that motivate me to go and apologize and seek their forgiveness, because that's a healing restoration that I need to seek with others. But that verse is that false guilt, because we can get tangled up in the two and stay stuck in false guilt when we've, you know, God's forgiven us, others have forgiven us, but what do? We just beat ourselves up with it, and then we miss out on that love that we could have by being restored.
Yes, we get over our pride that doesn't allow us to apologize and to make amends. Part of the 12-step program of making amends to people.
Mm. Yes, where you sit there and say, "I am." You own that in the 12 steps.
Yes, I just wanted to. You know, you and I have been talking earlier in the day. A lot of the thing that really draws me to Christ consciousness and to the image of Jesus is the healing. He was such a healer. The whole idea of him, you know, turning water into wine, or I don't even know my Bible very well, but his just laying on of hands and having people who couldn't walk get up and walk away and that kind of stuff. It just always attracted me to those of all, there's so many of us who are healers, and to heal as Jesus heals would be one of the greatest gifts in the world, to be able to do that. And you say in your book, the thing that you say is that the healing Jesus brings often begins with our injured image of him. And I thought, wow, that's a really powerful statement. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, for me, it was seeing God as that the cosmic killjoy, that vengeful, fearful God. And an example that comes to mind is about 25 years ago, I was going through some pastoral counseling about some anger issues that I was having. And mm-hmm. I think it was a couple of years after going through suicidal depression. And it's just, I was sitting there having coffee one day, and it broke through to my consciousness that I had a livid rage against God, and I was scared to death. And I just pressed it down, and I go, no, I love God. Because I was raised to think, man, you get angry and offend God, and it just, you know, smites you right there on the spot, a little bolt of lightning there. Sam, how do you like that? And but by the time I got to counseling that night, I told him, I said, you know, he goes, how was your day? And I'm like, oh, it's not good. I realize I'm very angry with God, and this counselor has the audacity to say, well, that's okay. And I went, no, I leaned up in the chair. I'm like, you don't understand. You know, and I poured out my beliefs about God, that injured view of God. And he goes, look, he said, have you ever held a hurt child in your arm that's just screaming and kicking against you? And he said, you know, that's God. He lets you rage against him deep down in your spirit on a subconscious level, because now I understand why you came through that suicidal depression, because I didn't avail myself of help. I was ashamed of it. And I really didn't know at the time how I came out of that. And, you know, some of the most devastating things we can do to self is we turn that anger in on ourselves,
yeah.
And it's so toxic, so destructive. He said, God's like that. He's been holding you and letting you kick against him because that was healthy for you. And I don't know if I can even finish the story. It still got a powerful effect on me all these years later. But for the first time, Kate, I felt how God must love me. I felt that love on a deep emotional level because I got it. I've done that with my sons. You know, I've never known really what that was like to have a father's love towards me. What does that even feel like? But as a father, and I have children and I love them, you know, as cops say, I take a bullet for them. But I love them, and I know what that feels like. But, you know, it still is pretty intellectual. But in that moment, I understood, and God used that moment to heal as part of that healing of that that injured image that I had of him. It's still almost incomprehensible. Because then I start wondering, well, why? You know, why would he?
Well, that was a turning point, huh?
It was. That pastoral counseling led into some going to a psychologist and beginning to deal with issues. And I don't want to scare anybody off just wondering, well, gosh, how long does it take if I start counseling now by saying I've been working on it 25 years? But that's been a hit or miss with insurance. You know, sadly.
But what is time, really? What is it? It doesn't exist, so.
Exactly. But, you know, when somebody's in it, when my wife of 27 years left me, we'd been together since high school, and the pain that I was in at that moment, I went in to talk to a pastor, and he goes, oh, this may take time. You know, it's going to take days, weeks, or months. And I got so angry, and I sat up, was tapping that table, and I said, Pastor, you don't understand. I can't bear another day of this pain. Don't talk to me about time. He just sat there smiling. And, of course, you know, then I felt, you know, about an inch tall, like, oh. And he said, he turned, and he pointed to a picture on the credenza behind him. He said, you see that picture, that young lady? I said, yes, I do. He said, that's my youngest daughter. See, when she was 17 years old, he goes, I stood there and watched her strapped down on a mattress in a treatment center going through withdrawals, just strapped out, you know, the four corners of the wall. I'm sure you've seen that, to keep from hurting herself. As she screamed and she raged to get him, against him, just pouring out all that anger and hurt. And he says, I felt literally like my heart was being taken out and just crushed.
Yeah.
He said,
well, yeah, when you think
pain.
Yeah. The worst thing in the world that he could ever imagine, and it really turned into a blessing because he was able to learn about love.
Yes. Yeah, his love for her. And that was 10 years prior to that. And he goes, she's come through that, and we have a wonderful relationship. And he goes, God loves you that way, and you will get through this. And, you know, again, another stepping stone, right, in that healing process.
That was
11 years ago, and I sat in his office, which was a few months after that, the marital separation. And not only did I survive, but came through it, you know, a better person for it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's part of what we need to remember when we're going through difficult times, is that it does turn into something that really benefits us.
Yes.
If we are open to it.
Mm. Now that's a key one right there. We got
to
be open.
If we're open to it. You got to be open. Now, you had said that you went through an experience where you allowed God to prune you. That was really a cool thing. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, and again, this was 11 years ago. It's about a week after that meeting with that pastor, and I was coming back from playing golf with my father-in-law at the time. He was a deeply spiritual man, survived just devastating cancer in which he had a esophageal a laryngectomy. He had esophageal cancer. But he's able to speak. You know, I prayed for him. When you're talking about Jesus healing people, at night of his surgery, I just prayed, Lord, just don't let him put the knife to him, and let him be able to remain and speak. But he went through the surgery. He couldn't talk, but he became one of the, this was 30 years ago, one of the first people in America to use esophageal speech, where I can talk to him on the phone, where he takes air into his stomach. Now, he has no larynx.
Right.
And you've heard kids talk as they belch, right? Well, he's developed it to the point that he can talk. Now, that's a miracle. That is a healing miracle. He's healed of that devastating terminal cancer, still alive today, still loves me like his own son. And this man's sitting over there, and he says, I've been in prayer for you, and God wants me to tell you that he wants your permission to prune you. Looked at him sideways, and I said, what does he need my permission to do anything? And he said, because if you say yes, it's going to hurt. I just started crying. I'm like, George, I can't take any more pain. I just can't. He goes, well, it's okay. If you say no, he'll still bless you. But if you say yes, he's going to take things out of your life so he can pour more in. He goes, you're so full of pain right now that you can't hold anymore. And that's true. But he's going to take this out, and he's going to measure that pain out to you in loving ways that you'll be able to bear it. And he's just going to pour your life full of promise, and you're going to bear fruit or good work through your life with that. So I thought about that, and what stuck in my mind, Kate, is like, in light of eternity, how can I say no? But it took me a couple of weeks to say yes because of the fear.
Mm-hmm.
And one night I was out working a security job in full uniforms about 2 o'clock in the morning. I looked out. I got out of the tennis court, and I'm pacing, and I'm praying, and I'm in so much pain. And I laid down on my face on that, and I said, God, I give you everything. And, you know, you may have heard, once you surrender to God, you would just feel peace. Well, I didn't. I was sick with fear about what was coming. And you know what? Over the next couple of years, the pain came, but it was measured out where I could deal with it. I had the grace to stand it. Just like you in the medical field, you know what someone can stand in pain. And sometimes surgical procedures take, you have to measure that out, and you have to do them in phases so the patient survives. And God's that way with us.
Oh, that's a really beautiful story, you know? I like that.
And I have to, my wife reminds me of that. You know, I'm like, wow, why am I being blessed like this? I have a book. I've got this opportunity to write and get this message out here. I'm meeting all these great people like this, and they're helping me. And she goes, because you said yes, you allowed that healing to take place, that wounded image of God to be healed within you and your spirit to be healed. And you've developed that love for people. And I do, Kate. It's hard. It's easy to say. I you know, but really, how do we show it? It just, Mm-hmm. I mean, and my book has an aspect of ways that we show that.
Mm-hmm.
God gives us the ways to find it, and he gives us that path to walk in, and actually gives us evidence that we can see that when you apply these principles, I mean, we should be able to see this progress, right? Transformational progress. I mean, if I'm going for medical treatment, I want to know, hey, doctor, when can I see progress? When is it going to get better, right? So sometimes
mm-hmm.
the process takes a while.
Yeah. We have to realize that the American society wants an instant fix. And then
the microwave.
Once we release that expectation, we're much better off, that's for sure.
Mm.
Well, and then you said something really cool that reminded me of the ordinary and the extraordinary, where you hear God's voice in a Waffle House. I mean, you know, that is so cool. And mystical experiences happen all over the place. And in the most mundane places in the world, I imagine a Waffle House. So
did I put Waffle House in there? I got to change that. I'm a Starbucks guy now, right? Oh,
well, that probably did it for you.
Yeah.
So what happened?
I purposely didn't mention that first time that I realized I was angry with God was in a Waffle House. But another time in Waffle House where God just, because, you know, I just tend to sit there and just relax. You know, I used to be in construction. You just go in there and you just let down for a moment and you tend to contemplate things. Where I felt like the Lord was asking me, he goes, why do you call me Lord? You don't do the things I say. Because I was doing harmful mm-hmm. things. I was addicted to internet pornography, and it's a very destructive, actually a chemically based addiction for the dopamine,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I just had the guilt with it and all. I would vow to do better. But there's just that loving rebuke from the Lord. It's like, look, if you want to get better, you got to make a change. You
mm-hmm.
can't continue on this destructive path. And so to hear that voice, sometimes it's clear, sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm.
I still struggle like anybody else in prayer. And, you know, prayer was the next thing on these commands of Christ, that we're to pray and give and teach others. Prayer is such a wonderful thing, and it, you know, there's so much written about it, you can't even go into a tenth of it, but it's that wonderful privilege to communicate with God. And when you can hear that voice, now I don't hear an audible voice from heaven like the Apostle Paul did. I think it'd scare me to death. It's just that internal impression on your mind. And sometimes
mm-hmm.
it's an absence of peace. I'm just disturbed in my spirit. There's something not right about this. And so, you know, it's mystical, and there's a mystery to it, but it's also a great adventure. You know, when you're looking for that voice or that leading, sometimes it's the voice of a friend will call. Just the right moment with encouragement. You know, and I've had people calling me all day going, hey, you know, we're praying for your interview that, I mean, sometimes when I get nervous, I tend to do like that Texas government, you know, it's the governor and I just go blank. That's been
mm-hmm.
my greatest fear, you know, public speaking. But when you have those friends that just speak into your life like that, that's a wonderful aspect of hearing from God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, because God speaks through everything, not just one thing, or
no.
not just what. If you have a preconceived notion, it's not really serving you, I don't think. So it's best to just let go of all of these preconceived notions and be open to the messages that come through, say, little children or. I mean, I'm a labor and delivery nurse, so every time I see a newborn child, that's just an example.
Wow.
There's nothing like that. That wise old soul in a tiny little baby's body. Unbelievable, really, how
mm-hmm.
much they seem to, the wisdom, they seem to know everything. And, of course, then they have to hopefully go home to a good life and not get beaten up and stuff. But
no, but ideally, when they're loved on, by the time they're two, they're going on 30.
That's especially this day and age. You know, there's a real heavy need to grow up very fast, or I should
mm-hmm.
say a need, that there's a need to grow up really fast.
Yeah.
So do you see that your message will go out mostly? Are you speaking to a Christian audience, or do you see yourself speaking to a wider range within the spiritual community as well? Or how, and also, how do you blend the spiritual and the religion in your own mind?
I actually hold, you know, Christian convictions, because I'm a skeptic, and I tend to think in, you know, all or nothing terms. And so I want to know what's true. And so, you know, so for me, I want to know exactly what is truth at its core. And I study the world's major religions looking for what, you know, I could believe in is truth. And I don't go around with a Bible beating people over the head and go, you know, it's my way or the highway. It's not my place. But for me, I'm comfortable with the Christian teachings of absolutes, because it gives me peace knowing that there's some things, like my relationship with God, it's not going to change. It's not dependent on my behavior and my conduct. Now, I can affect the relationship, just like your child that acts out. You still love them, but you can't have that good relationship until they do what's right. And, you know, God has to have rules. And religion's got rules that sometimes are necessary. It's just when they hold them out as this absolute dogma. It's not taught in the Bible.
Yeah.
And we go back to Jesus came to bring love, but he was crucified. He was put to death by the religious establishment of his day because he pointed at them and said, these were his own people. And he said, your religion, the way you're living it, will not get you to heaven.
Right.
You're holding impossible burdens over people. And so I've got the Christian convictions of the messages of Christ. So the book teaches from that standpoint, but I would hope that I can offer hope and encouragement to anyone that reads the message. Okay, if you don't want to, you know, to submit yourself as it is to the teachings and become a follower of Christ, you can still implement principles of that. Now, having said that, being a Christian, I believe in a literal heaven and hell, and the Bible puts forth a clear way to avoid it. God's forgiveness, as put forth in the Bible, is very, very clearly spelled out, right? And so, you know, I build the principle, foundational principles on that is you have to obtain the forgiveness of God first and go into the details of that with the scriptural references. The evidences of a spirit-filled life of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, I mean, good people have those. But these, and it's not to say that, you know, only Christians have these, but if we're lacking in this, and we need a roadmap to see the markers, by, we need evidence in our life, then we should start enjoying and seeing love. Love is the first thing Paul wrote about in Galatians 5:22. And then joy. And, you know, I sought joy for so long, but I thought it's mutually exclusive to pain. So I'm like, well, if I get rid of all these painful things, then I can be joyful. But I've had joy while weeping. You know, they go side by side. You can have hope and be in hopeless circumstances. And that's the promise of this book. You can have both. And, and to go down and exercise kindness for somebody, you've done it. You love on somebody and be kind to them. You see that face light up. I love going to Asia. And a simple act is just to go back into a kitchen anywhere. You can do it here, but I love doing it in Asia. And where you go back into a village and you want to talk to those who are working in the kitchen, and they're have these frowns on their face, and they're just like, what does this foreigner want back here? And through the interpreter, you say, I enjoyed that meal. Thank you. Thank you for the work you put into it. That was good food. Is there anything better than seeing that face light up with joy?
Oh, that gratitude. Oh, giving gratitude is really a beautiful gift.
It really is. And it ties in with other aspects listed there in the Bible of goodness, faithfulness, gentleness. And he anchors it with self-control, because if we can't gain a semblance of control over ourselves, we're never going to be able to transform. Mal Duane, in her book Alpha Chicks, speaks to that very powerfully on how you've got to choose to purpose this change in your life. And I hold that out. I want to impart that hope to anyone that reads Bridge Building.
Yeah, let me just say that Mal Duane just released her book, Alpha Chick, today. If you go to alphachick.com, you can get some good gifts from her if you buy the book today. So just to make explain that reference, because it is. Mal was on this show a few weeks ago. If you want to go back and listen to that archive, it's very, very good to listen to her point of view, because talking about suffering, and of her spiritual path is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and which is a very powerful path. In a way, I think we all approach recovery in different ways and from and different paths, and I think it all meets sort of in the same unified place.
Yes, there are some set principles that apply across the board, but then there is that freedom to follow our own path. And it doesn't have to be this rigid way of Sam Bradley's or anyone else, but it's just like a guide going ahead, showing and showing a way that way. And it, you know, when we're on that topic of our own path of recovery, I want to encourage anyone listening who may have been able to identify with some of these issues and topics that we've covered to begin now in their own spiritual journey to healing and wholeness. I mean, but you can change. Just don't give up. A day will come when you notice a difference and you realize that real progress, even in the face of continued struggles, especially with addiction, but there's progress there. And you're worthy of that effort. We all are, regardless of how it feels when you're in the depth of that struggle and the guilt that you're carrying. The struggle is worth it, Kate. It really is.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting that there's such an epidemic of addiction, and that's not just the drugs and alcohol, but, well, prescription drugs is a biggie these days, and as you mentioned, pornography, and there's just an addiction to perfection. There's an
addiction.
Perfectionism is horrible. Yeah, there's an addiction to the need to be right. There's an addiction to all these things that hold us back. But in the end, these addiction, this epidemic of addictions is really, if people can find the spiritual strength to walk away from it and get help and all those things that we need to do, it's just an amazing path to transformation or spirituality and to have those experiences.
It is. You know, Kate, hope is the key. You know, when I was Googling keywords on putting up a new website lately, I always had thought of hope and encouragement as interchangeable, but on Google, there are 660,000 hits on encouragement a month, but on hope, there's 13,600,000 hits a month on hope. And without hope, where do we start? And
you're gonna have to narrow that keyword down a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. And that's the great thing. Like you said earlier, just narrow that focus and grab onto one thing. And that's what I've tried to do with bridge building. You know, when I'm really overwhelmed mentally, I can't go through a thick, complicated workbook. I've got to have something simple, and I've tried to write this simply. You can even scan through to part three. Just find something and hang on to it, right? Just hang on to that hope.
Yeah, you realize we've come to the end of the program. You did a great job. This is your debut.
You.
Congratulations.
I know you're a plank owner in my success, and I would like to offer, if anyone listening would grab a pen, give them my website for any follow-up questions, suggestions, feedback.
Please.
All right, so anyone listening, if you have a question or comment for me, please visit my website at the following address. It's www.hopesharbor, that's one word, hopesharbor.net. Send me an email on the contact page, and you give me your feedback, even if it's negative. I'll do what I can with it, and you'll help my bridge building that much better.
That's right. Absolutely. So,
Hopesharbor.
Hopesharbor.net.
Dot net, yes.
Yes. Well,
and
Sam,
also,
thank you so much.
Let Kate, You're welcome. I just wanted to encourage them to let you know their thoughts, because us writers, we need encouragement too.
Yes, absolutely right. So we'll see everybody who's on Facebook, come on over and like Sam Bradley and get him to, you know, get him as a friend of yours, because he's a wonderful guy.
Thank you.
It was wonderful to meet you, Sam. Really great to meet you. So I'm going to be playing music. Yes, music for Mother and Child by Klaus D. Jensen. And here it is. Have a great night.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Good night.